Great pleasure to introduce Tristan Michel, who's going to give us a talk on why we have rights. Are you ready, Tristan?
Yep. Thank you. Thank you very much, and thank you for having me. It was a bit at the last minute because David called me. When was it? Friday,
I think. Oh yes, it was very late, actually.
And so on. So I decided that rather than doing a original piece, I would simply talk about something that I had talked about before. Not here, not even in London, but of all places, in Bulgaria. And I don't think it affects. I mean, I'm going to speak in my accented English, but not in Bulgarian, but just to let you know. So the issue that I will be addressing today, as David said, is why we have rights. And I will start by saying that rights are the means by which we can reasonably predict human behavior. Without predictability, the existence of higher life forms would be impossible. The water source should be at the end of the same track beaten each morning. Berries, which have always been edible, should not suddenly become poisonous. Species, which have never posed a threat, should not suddenly become predatory. When we and animals experience something that goes directly against our fundamental expectations, stress and anxiety ensue. Even when the consequences are not life-threatening. The purpose of science and of gaining personal experience is to establish a chain of cause and effect which we can then anticipate. We can count on the bridge to bear our weight, on the plane to defy gravity, on drugs to cure us. Science boosts our sense of confidence in the world, even if, through changing our environment, it itself, in turn, creates the unexpected. The degree of confidence we have in our predictions diminishes when we are dealing with the behavior of higher life forms. Evolution programs in freedom. Indeed, freedom is fundamental to evolution. If in fleeing, antelope always veered to the right, their predators would have already wiped out the species. We humans are programmed to find individual and original solutions to our problems, and it is both the elevation and the tragedy of human condition. Anticipating human behavior is therefore a risky business. We are one of many species whose members kill one another. Preying on our fellows is a fundamental feature of our humanity, falling into direct conflict with another feature, that of man as a social animal. How can we reconcile our violent impulses with the need to live together? Society demands that predation be checked. As a group member, we have reasonable expectations concerning other members, that they will not murder us in our sleep, that they will not assault us when we go out at night. These expectations do not only concern our person, but our property as well. All human languages have a concept of a personal pronoun and a gerund. These universal language forms indicate the linkage that a human being establishes between herself and another, between himself and an object. Not just any man, but my friend. Not just any tool, but mine, one which I've made, which I've used, and which I can reasonably expect to be using again. That linkage is established through birth, my child, between consenting adults, my spouse, through homesteading, my land, which I settled before anybody else did, through transfer by mutual consent, my book, for which I've paid the price asked by the seller. Who could make a stronger claim? Those who are not the parents, those who have not first tilled the soil, those who have not paid for the book? By publicly declaring this linkage, we are counting on others to respect it. We are counting on reaping the harvest from the field at which we went to all the trouble of sowing. This expectation is reasonable, and when it is dashed, especially through the deliberate actions of other members of our society, confiscating an owner's dwelling, taking a child away from her mother, we feel stress, anxiety, and deep resentment. A society that placed no bounds on rape, pillage, and murder would disintegrate. Its members would defect. Without these limitations, society would be impossible. It is intrinsic to the nature of every social group that each member can rely on others not to arbitrarily rob them of their lives or their assets. Each of us reasonably declares this as a right. Humans are fundamentally social animals. There is no such thing as a non-socialized human being. And it is in the nature of society for these rights to be at least partially respected. This is why these are termed natural rights, not that it is in the nature of human beings to have rights, I'm not going to open this debate, but that it is in the nature of human society. In other words, it's not that rights are rooted in the nature of human beings, but that they are in the nature of a social group. So these rights were not invented by governments, as the proponents of positive rights maintain. Neither have they arisen on the back of nothing more than convention. They are the very stuff of our social existence. A rag-tailed bunch of shipwrecked survivors dragging themselves ashore on a desert island would have to respect these rights from the outset, simply in order to function as a social unit, even before establishing any institution. The purpose of politics is to create exceptions to rights so that all members of society no longer share rights equally, identically. So there are two forms of exception to rights. Everyone is exempted from respecting another person's right in certain clearly defined circumstances. For instance, each of us has a right to kill our aggressor if we are acting in self-defense. And the other form of exception is that certain clearly defined persons are exempted from respecting other people's rights in all circumstances. They are the government. The government may rob and kill with impunity when they declare this transgression to be in the name of taxation, just war, reason of state, and so on. We not only demand of people that they refrain from attacking us, we base our own set of reasonable expectations on their behavior. Should their behavior fail to meet our expectations, we experience disappointment, stress, and anxiety. We feel wrong. A custom is a good example of a behavior that it would be reasonable to assume will be perpetuated. In many societies, custom dictates the giving of gifts, for instance, at a wedding. A relative failing to respect this custom would grieve, or at least annoy, the bride and groom. It would be appropriate to sanction this failure to comply with their reasonable expectations through a well-placed remark, or by neglecting to invite the offending relative to the next family occasion. By the same token, if for years a villager has been taking a shortcut across a neighbor's field without any opposition on the neighbor's part, this villager would feel resentment and a sense of loss should the neighbor suddenly bar her route. These expectations would have been perfectly legitimate, just as is understandable the stress and anxiety at seeing them disappointed. They would have been better founded and would have become indisputable rights had, for example, the neighbors signed an agreement according the villager right of way across the field. The party's intention and their reasonable expectations concerning the behavior of others suffice to create a right. But as popular wisdom reminds us, that which goes without saying is much better said and even better written down. Rights born of such contracts and agreements are no longer natural, not inherent or common to all societies, as is the respect for life and property. They illustrate the wide breadth of human commitments according to their historical context and level of development. The sale of a radio frequency would have made scant sense in medieval time. Parties devise strategies, base investments, and enter into further agreements with other parties on the strength of these promises. Were the contracting party to renege on their obligations, those relying on them would be disappointed and sometimes gravely injured. Conflicting desires reign in every human heart. These desires compete fiercely for a human being's limited resources, his time, his body, his energy, and the use of his natural possessions. Our moral life centers on setting priorities for these irreconcilable desires, to work or laze around, to drink or drive, to have an affair or stay faithful, to focus on career ambitions or to bring up a family. The majority of our choices indicate the value we place on linkages, as each linkage has a value, even if that value is priceless, as when people say, "I wouldn't part with that for love nor money." Value is that which one acts to gain when we don't have it, and to keep when we do, as in the words of Ayn Rand. We cannot make a distinction concerning the nature of the value we place on linkages, only concerning their intensity. The death of a child, the loss of an object, of a job, of a hope, causes us vastly different levels of anxiety and suffering. But that sense of loss is always felt. The best evidence for the common nature of these linkages is our ability to substitute one for another. Values are fungible. Some would refuse, and others would jump at the chance of a juicy promotion at the expense of a colleague, all according to the respective value each one places on loyalty and money. Each of us has a right to create a linkage or to choose not to do so. Take literary example. Charlotte has a right to reject the linkage that Werther would like to create between them, even if it drives a young Werther to commit suicide. He is expecting a form of happiness from this linkage, which is not what she has in mind. She's looking to achieve her happiness through creating a linkage with someone else, Albert, whilst running the inevitable risk of being disappointed. In much the same way, the owners of a cherry orchard in Chekhov's play reject Lopakhin's crass offer to divide it into building lots. They badly need the money, but they place an even greater value on the orchard's magical beauty. Therefore, the only limit to our creating new linkages with people, both in relation to themselves and to objects, is their right of refusal. We do not want to be forced into a marriage, friendship, employment, nor to be forced to buy or sell. And we find it reasonable not to impose these demands on others. We intrinsically believe that each of us should have the possibility of evaluating his existing ties, to exchange these or not to do so, in accordance to what he believes will be the satisfaction that he and his counterparty will each derive from that exchange. However, this is not always the case. In the 1970s, I was a frequent visitor to New York, and there a young man from the South Bronx took me under his wing. His sense of property was highly selective, inviolable if it was the case of one of his acquaintances. He wouldn't have walked off with my biro pen. Anyone else's was fair game. One day, when I made a passing remark about how nice it would be to cycle through Central Park, he immediately suggested that he should get me a bike. How many gears do you want? What color? No doubt, he would have got me the bike of my dreams within 48 hours. My friend Cornell would have been bound by his promise. He would have entered into a contract. But concerning an article which did not belong to him, and consequently one that would not have belonged to me either, the chain of transfers by mutual consent would have been broken. Someone's deliberate act would have deprived a man, somewhere or other, of a bicycle he counted on, his bicycle, his travel plans thwarted, both the bike's usage and its expected resale value gone. What if Cornell had been a trickster trumped? Surely he would have felt the same anger and frustration as his victim if, looking forward to delivering to me what he had promised, one of his ilk had pinched that bike. But in taking possession of that bicycle, Cornell had not been assigned the right to sever the linkage between this object and its owner. Only through a party's consent may a linkage to an object be assigned without disappointing their expectations and without causing them suffering. Only rights are transferable, not property itself. Those who take possession of a piece of property disregarding the owner's intention to transfer his right do not break the linkage between that property and its owner. What grounds would I have had to object had the owner come and reclaimed what had never stopped being his bicycle? In others, we hope to find certain behaviors, although those behaviors neither stem from their personal commitment, nor are they set in stone by custom. We would like them to be polite, helpful, hospitable. If my car breaks down, I would like a driver to give me a lift to the next village. But it would be unreasonable to assume that the first one who comes along will be the one to do it. I do not have any right to assistance. I have a reasonable expectation that the employees of an establishment open to the public, such as this one, will treat me with courtesy. But is it my right? Precedence would imply so, but the right to demand deference towards customers belongs to the employer if she has taken care to incorporate the specific written clause into her workers' employment contracts. On the other hand, if I pay pension contributions or health insurance premiums, I am counting on the service providers to deliver. As far as I am concerned, I am covered for these eventualities. I would feel seriously let down were these organizations to renege on their obligations either through dishonesty or bankruptcy. But can I reasonably require of people who do not know me and who do not have any personal obligation towards me to care for me in my old age, to cover the cost of my hospitalization, or to support me whilst unemployed? Governments arrogate to themselves a quasi-monopoly on social services on which they hope to base the legitimacy of their power. They create and fulfill expectations by forcing others, taxpayers, to bail out social security and pension systems. But in fulfilling these expectations, doesn't this place them, governments, in the same position as Cornell, offering me something that doesn't belong to him? What's the difference? From him as well, I was certain of receiving the bike, but at the cost of the owner's frustration and resentment, and by thwarting his travel plans, a cost I was not prepared to meet myself, nor was Cornell. So how come we would impose it on someone else? Does not forced redistribution make each benefit recipient a receiver of stolen goods? This brings us to the other way of creating predictability in society, not through rights, but through commands. After all, as Benjamin Franklin famously remarked, I'm sure it's in one of David's books, There are only two certainties in this mortal coil, death and taxes. The government sends out tax demands to millions of households and can, with reasonable certainty, expect that 95% plus of people will comply. This predictability is even greater when members of another form of racket threaten to nail your kneecaps to the floor should you fail to stump up your protection money within 10 days. Thus, there are two means of creating predictability in human societies: commands to do something and rights that we may not be subjected to do something or to not do it. The fundamental difference between liberalism and all other political philosophies is that in all instances, liberals accord rights precedence over commands. So to preempt Jan's question, Popperian question, which I'm sure he's going to ask, the purpose of all these words is to assess what is the legitimate predictability that we can find in society and why this sort of predictability is the only legitimate one. But is this position that only rights can assure legitimate predictability in human societies, is this position tenable in the real world? After all, coordination is necessary within the innumerable organizations that provide us the material and cultural benefits of a developed society. And coordination is necessary between these organizations. But all coordination is an exercise of power. You do this, and you do that. We say that this power is legitimate when it is based on the express consent of those over whom it is exercised. Consent is even more firmly guaranteed by the narrowness of the object one is consenting to. The artistic director gives actors directions. The teacher gives out homework. The fire chief orders a drill. Recipients of these commands voluntarily place themselves under the orders of the person giving them, notably by signing a contract and the organization's internal rules and regulations. In other words, the recipient of those orders has provisionally foregone her right not to be physically subjected to someone's authority. She foregoes that right because she shares a common goal with the order giver: to put on a play, sit for an exam, or put out fires. And the scope of his commands is limited to the realization of his goal. But the members of the organization would walk away from it, just as they joined it, if the organization were no longer the means of achieving their personal goals. In other words, it is not the goal of the organization that the person pursues, but her personal goal through the organization. To deny this possibility of secession, if the goal of the organization no longer corresponds to personal goals, would be to ride roughshod over persons' rights, to subject them to more than they have agreed to. Giving them orders irrelevant to the stated goal, such as sleep with me or paint my kitchen, would be unacceptable, except where the parties concerned had, of their own volition, agreed to a new goal distinct from the first. The narrow focus of the goal also limits the size of the organization. And at the same time, specialization ensures its relative simplicity. Limiting the amount of information handled by the hierarchy means the chain of command can be more effective. But what is the goal of civil society? What is the aim of a country such as this one, the UK, or France, or Bulgaria, as I mentioned earlier? To become the richest country in Europe, or a great military power, or a model of social justice? If the goal is too broad, there is no limit to the scope of the orders. Everything becomes political. The private sphere is absorbed into the public sphere, watched over by commissars. If the goal is narrow, we cannot imagine it being shared by all. And even if, extraordinarily, that were the case, not everyone would agree on how to achieve it. So the chain of command would no longer be legitimate and not founded on consent, and it would meet with resistance or defection, as indeed it does today. Dissipation of information and ineffectiveness would ensue. This is the core failing of all bureaucracies, be they public or private. The downfall of bureaucracies lies in their incapacity to manage complexity. The hierarchy cannot access all information. The most powerful computer, we know this, could not process it, as information resides in people's heads, and only actions reveal people's preferences. Thus, the hierarchy must resolve to impede initiative, stamp on every innovation, and stifle complexity, lest its commands be hopelessly tardy and irrelevant. I mean, when a bureaucracy reaches this stage, it is effectively bankrupt. Financiers cease funding it, employees are dismissed, assets are auctioned off. Historically, state bureaucracies became incapable of managing the complexity of an industrial economy sometime between 1910 and 1930. Depending on the country concerned, impeccable observers recorded these failings. But these bureaucracies were not dissolved. Taxpayers have continued to pay for their upkeep, and for an obvious reason. And so it has not been possible to put a new means of organizing the economies of these countries into place. It's not been possible to test whether an economy based on rights and not on commands would have been possible. A command works better when it is internalized. Rather than waiting for the master to give an order, the individual carries that master within herself at all times. Information no longer needs to travel up and down the hierarchy. The individual is deemed to have already internalized commands to apply in each and every circumstance. This is the goal of morality. But a moral code is intrinsically a personal commitment. It creates predictability for that individual. We can hope that a great number of individuals internalize certain core values, but just as we have seen with hospitality and mutual aid, we cannot legitimately demand it. The confusion of morality with legislation forms the root of fundamentalism. Fundamentalism is simply confusing morality and rights, morality and legislation. Politics based on moral order are a contradiction in terms and doomed to failure. In a complex world where no situation ever presents itself in exactly the same fashion, right foster negotiations to adjust individual actions. The market is the medium for these adjustments. But when the law has been internalized, the individual has no one with whom to negotiate adjustments. Can one negotiate with himself? Faced with a new situation, an individual will be inflicting a useless deprivation on himself and/or his loved ones, were he to apply a more rigorous moral criterion than his own morality would demand, or else he would end up experiencing guilt were he to act with laxity. The economist recognizes this situation where dialogue is absent, contracts impossible. It is called a command economy. Prices are set outside the market, too high and production surplus results wasted, too low and demand remain unsatisfied. In all cases, the command, either internal morality or external in the economy, coupled with the impossibility of negotiations, weakens the social fabric. Of course, there is no island left in our globalized world, no place to hide. History engages all. Those human groups where dialogue and negotiations are stifled are extremely vulnerable now that they are in contact with other groups that have reached a higher, more liberal stage of development. Societies that are insufficiently complex adapt through violent transformation, as say Muslim societies today, or are shattered out of existence, as are primitive societies. Of course, a fraught relationship exists between centers and margins, majorities and minorities, dominant and subordinate cultures, with the realization that dissidents may not only be repressed by the dominant, but in a sense, actually created by it. In other words, herd morality, being intrinsically reactive, is defined by what it is not, by what it fears, and by what it excludes. It is the state police itself which produces the figure of a dissident, religion of whatever persuasion, that of a heretic, the moral order, that of a pervert. So let us celebrate dissidents, strength we preserve, but it is dissidence and transgression that advance man as a species. The good society creates reasonable expectations through its institutions, its customs, respect for contracts. It diminishes the stress and anxiety placed on its members through not subjugating them to any linkage, no forced marriage, no caste, no legal monopoly of public service providers. People are allowed to form the linkages they choose. Amongst themselves, friendship, partnership, and amongst themselves concerning objects, property rights. In this way, the good society maximizes each person's chances of creating the most beneficial and strongest linkages. I'll jump to the conclusion, because I see that it's time to jump to the conclusion. And simply ask, will we ever achieve the a good society? And I'll leave that to a discussion.
Christian, quite right, said he took this talk at very, very short notice and he's given a magnificent performance, I think.
Oh, yes.
And a very good thesis.
That's a repeat.
Jan?
You were wrong in your prediction about my question. I formed my question at the very beginning. Unless I misunderstood you, you suggested that we must have these rights for predictability, and also that if we deviate from rights, we create privilege and underprivilege. I know you didn't actually use those words, but that seemed to be what you indicated. Now, if the state announces that there shall be, people shall be allowed to do these things and not those things, and then it enforces them rigorously, up to and including the death penalty, you're going to get predictability. So you can have predictability without that. But also, I don't see that privilege and underprivilege necessarily comes in. If you say all white males shall be allowed X and nobody else, then there's some obvious privilege built in there. But if you just say, well, anybody whose income falls below such and such a level is entitled to this, you can that well, you can say, well, some people's income will never fall, but you know, but in principle it could apply to anybody. So there's no inherent privilege and underprivilege.
Yes, I haven't spoken, as you said, of privilege and underprivilege, but I can see that I was really soporific, because the second part of my talk was precisely about the other way of creating predictability in society, which is through commands. And I was mentioning exactly what you said. In other words, if a government, for instance, sends out, I took the example of tax notices to the population, it could, I mean, the government can predict very reasonably that 95% of people would comply. And I said that, you know, there is another way that other group of people create predictability, like mafias, when they say, I'm not speaking of death penalty, but they can go around and say, if you don't stump up, you know, your protection money, we are going to break your legs. And that is probably reaching 99% of predictability. So, yes, these are the two ways of creating predictability in society. Commands, you know, to do something, and rights, that you may not be done something to you or do something to others that would violate their rights. and it's you know, the liberal, I think, to liberalism's credit, that they would consider that only rights are legitimate, property rights.
Before we go into this, do we want to have we want to have a short break for the break?
A quick get the pint in break. Yeah.
Do we want to?
Yes, a very quick one, just not
okay,
10 minutes.
Coffee to wake people up.
I don't think at all. Suffering at all.
No. A very quick and a pint in break.
Yes, I thought, you know, shall we?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll have 10 minutes then.
Also allows me to get the recordings below 80 minutes, which is what CDs like to have.